Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from Relator in Liberty National Fire versus Aiken.
May it please the court, Mr. Larry Gulliher will present argument for the Relator. Relator has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
As stated, my name is Larry Gulliher and I represent the Liberty National Fire Insurance Company in this mandamus. The underlying suit is a suit upon a homeowner's insurance policy for alleged settling damage to the foundation of the house. The trial court entered three separate orders or rulings in this case. This was done by the respondent, former Judge Aiken. He first sustained a motion by my client for a severance and entered an order that the bad faith part of this case would be tried separately from the underlying contract action and that the bad faith case would be abated. Upon motion for reconsideration by the real party in interest in this case, he set aside that order, and then on motion for reconsideration by Liberty National, he reaffirmed that the bad faith case and the contract case would be tried together. It is that last order of the court to which we seek a writ of mandamus to set aside and to require that the bad faith case be tried separately and after the contract case.
May I ask you about the extraordinary nature of this proceeding as opposed to an ordinary appeal, why mandamus is appropriate? Is it your contention that Judge Aiken, there is no set of circumstances, that is, no rulings that the trial court might make during the course of the trial, no instructions the court might give to the jury that would cure the prejudice that you say would arise as a result of trial of the joint claims?
That is our position, Your Honor.
And explain that, please.
All right. First, Your Honor, it's based on two principles. The first one is that the bad faith case should come second because it is based upon a final resolution of liability on the contract, as held by this court in the Stoker case of last summer. So since it must be based upon contractual liability, we believe to allow the jury to speculate in a single trial that the insurance company must be liable on the contract is inherently fallacious.
Under the horseshoe operating case that you cite on the law of severance, why aren't these claims so interwoven as to involve the same facts and issues and thus not subject to severance? Aren't the facts
No, Your Honor, they're not. The facts are entirely different. And in fact, if I understand the contentions of my adversary, they are even saying that it is not the denial of the claim. In fact, they themselves say that they are entirely separate. And her position is that it's not the denial of the claim even from which the bad faith claim arises, but instead it's from a prejudiced investigation before the denial of the claim. And it's that evidence on this alleged prejudiced investigation, and there are a number of items here which I will go through before I conclude, evidentiary items which the plaintiff in this case wishes to offer, which have nothing to do whatsoever with whether the contract claim is valid or not.
You never made any offer of settlement in this case, is that right?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
You never made any offer of settlement in the case prior to the trial, is that right?
No, we did make an offer of settlement even before the lawsuit was filed. That was an $1,800 offer of settlement, which is undisputed between the parties. It's disputed, I believe. They take issue and they say that an insurance offer or an offer by an insurance company to pay a claim is something different than a compromise settlement offer under Rule 408. They've got this argument, but there's no doubt that an offer was made, Your Honor.
Assuming you're right that there was, that there's no difference between an offer made pre-suit and one made during the course of the lawsuit, should the right to mandamus under these circumstances depend on whether there was an offer at all?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor.
Let's say in a case where there is no offer.
Right.
There can't be any prejudice from having made one, so what's why the mandamus?
Your Honor, I believe that we have come to the point in the jurisprudence of this state that when a motion for severance is filed in a case such as this, that the trial court really has no discretion and it should grant the severance and that there should be a separate trial. I do not believe that it should depend upon there being a settlement offer that's been made. But we do have a settlement offer in this case, and we have a number of other facts also, Your Honor, which would not be admissible in the contract suit, but which one side or the other wishes to introduce.
Is an abatement required too, like Judge Aiken initially ordered, or an abatement of the discovery?
I don't know that abatement of discovery is necessarily required. I think it's a good idea. I think the main thing is, from our point of view, Your Honor, that the jury trial be held after a final determination of the contract.
Two separate juries, or could you have...
Yes, I think it's two separate juries. I believe we're talking about a true severance. And we're talking about some time in between. And yes, there may be discovery on the bad faith case in between the trial of the contract case. It's just that I do not wish to advocate that there must be an abatement in every case of that discovery.
Would you have us go as far as Mid-Century did and wait till the contract portion of it had been appealed and was final?
Well, as one court of appeals case, it seems to indicate that, and so I would go along with that, yes. I believe it should be a final judgment.
What prejudice would occur, though, if the second trial were able to go forward while the other ones going through the appellate process? That would.
And then if it was just, if the first case was reversed, then the second case would just automatically be reversed, I suppose there wouldn't be any prejudice, Your Honor. So that's why I don't think that is a, you know, a big point. I merely point out that the one of the Houston courts has followed that rule and held that after severing a case, that it was error to then consolidate them because that denied the right of appeal.
We have a bifurcation at least, through severance, I guess, in punitive damages. Now you advocate a mandatory severance here.
That is true.
What type of precedent are we setting for piecemeal cases in other areas? I mean, who's going to be next?
Your Honor, it may be that the bifurcation as announced by the Morial case would fall into disuse because I believe the true bifurcation should be at this level between the contract case and the bad faith case. So I don't think that it's a bad precedent because the Morial...
This would not result in trifurcation of this type of case, you're saying?
Right, because the Morial bifurcation is a trial before, as I understand it, before the same jury immediately after determination of liability on exemplary damages.
But in what other types of cases will people say, the Supreme Court has now recognized that we're not going to be to let prejudicial evidence for one claim come in that might affect the other claim. What litigants are going to come next?
I understand what you're saying.
This trend?
And I have not given that any thought of what other cases might fall within such a rule. I think that the bad faith situation is such an extraordinary circumstance where punitive damages are sought, such a heavy burden, that to avoid prejudice in the contract case, and that's really what we're talking about, that severance is required.
Why wouldn't bifurcation work? Why do you want a separate jury?
Oh, have the second jury decide the...
Why do you want a second jury as opposed to the same jury decide the bad faith?
Merely because I think it is a true severance, and if the court disagrees and it should not be a true severance, that it ought to only be a separate trial,
then, you know, I don't have a strong feeling on that, Your Honor. I do not see that that is really important. It merely follows from a true severance. The same jury could decide the liability. It's just I think it would be very inconvenient for the jury if the court not only granted the severance but stayed the discovery, abated the discovery in the bad faith case. Then we're talking about a time lag. We may not be able to get the original jurors back. I just think it's unworkable if it's done that way.
Your position, I believe, is that the evidence of bad faith is so prejudicial, and if there was just a trial of the contract claim, it would be inadmissible.
That's correct.
But often, isn't it intertwined, the investigation that was performed, the testimony as to the facts of the claim?
It may be sometimes very intertwined. It's not what we have here, however, because they're not complaining in the bad faith case about the denial. They're complaining about what I guess would be a huge conspiracy between the insurance company and its adjusters to always deny claims of this type. And they wish to go into that. They wish to prove that the engineer that we hired allegedly always finds no coverage, and therefore we're going to have to put on evidence to block that. The bad faith case is just an entirely different item from whether the water from this little sewer leak caused this house, the foundation, to settle, and if so, how much damage that caused. From a very simple contract case.
From your answer to Judge Spector's question, it sounds like you're saying there may be some bad faith cases where it would not be prejudicial to try them together because the facts are so intertwined. You're saying, as I understand it, this is not one of those cases.
That's right, Your Honor.
But are you asking for a general rule that in all bad faith cases there must be either bifurcation or severance, or are you just saying in some of them, this one in particular?
Yes, Your Honor. I guess I'm really saying both. I really think, Your Honor, that this court should adopt the rule that there is no discretion in the trial court under this fact situation, and that a severance should be ordered. But, of course, I'm only here to advocate the case of my client, and I believe that the facts in this case certainly very strongly cry out for such a severance.
Piggybacking on a question asked by Justice Corwin, what you opened, you know, this is a mandamus. In Lunsford, I criticize my colleagues for changing 100 years of law in a mandamus context because we should change the rules, and the trial court were just following the law as it existed at that time. Why is this not any different? There is no rule at the moment that requires a severance or bifurcation. So how can we say that the trial court abused its discretion if it was following existing law?
Well, Your Honor, I guess the answer to that is I believe there is such a rule and that there is such a law. It just hasn't come from this court. And that is, there are so many cases by the First Court of Appeals and by the 14th Court of Appeals that indicate that under the facts of this case, severance is required. And they're not a whole lot of cases that I'm aware of on the other side. So the only problem is this court has not declared that principle. We thought that the trial court in this case should have followed the Court of Appeals rulings, and that to fail to do that was an abuse of discretion.
Your argument assumes, I think, that under Stoker, successful defense of the contract claim will automatically entitle you to judgment on the bad faith claim. Is that correct? Did I understand you correctly?
Yes. We realize, Your Honor, that that's the general rule.
Right. Well, I was going to ask you about the exception. Where the claim is not that the insurance company showed bad faith in denying a claim, but by virtue of the investigation, perhaps causing some other harm other than the denial of the claim per se, would you still advocate the same rule?
As far as the severance?
As far as severance?
As far as the severance, I would, Your Honor.
Even though there will be no, you would not be entitled to summary judgment?
Right. Right. I still believe, Your Honor, that that evidence on the bad faith case, which we're both sides are talking about in this case, would so severely taint the contract trial that the defendant insurance company could not receive a fair trial on the contract case alone. And let me, since I've not had an opportunity to talk about that type of evidence, I think I ought to at least tell you the type of things that we are talking about in this case. We've already mentioned the settlement offer. In addition to that, there is a reserve.
Which would have to come into evidence at the trial in this case.
Yes, these are items that would come into evidence if they're tried together, and if they're not tried together, these are items that would come into evidence in the bad faith case, but which we believe are prejudicial and should not be considered in the contract case. Those items include settlement offers, and by the way, we're not the only ones that made a settlement offer. The other side had a settlement offer, although, and they refer to it as an offer, but they don't discuss it in their brief, and that, well, they discuss it in their brief, they just don't put it in the same category. And that is, Mrs. Broderick offered to have the two engineers get a third engineer to break the tie, and we refused to accept that offer. And that somehow leads into their bad faith claim.
Y'all heard the settlement that your company offered, was that to cover some parts of the damage, the plumbing leak or something?
It was to cover some parts of the damage.
It was not to, it was simply your saying under the contract we're obligated this much and that's what we're paying, right?
That's right.
And during the trial of whether or not this damage is covered or not, would it not come into the trial in this case that the insurance company acknowledges that certain portions of the damage are covered?
Well, that payment was made for, or was tendered, because it wasn't ever accepted. That payment was tendered for the entire claim, Your Honor. It's true that it was calculated and based upon various items of plumbing repair and floor repair and that sort of thing. But the offer was tendered as a payment of the entire claim and was rejected.
In the trial of this case, the insurance company would acknowledge that certain parts of the claim were covered.
It's possible that that could somehow even be removed, Your Honor, from the evidence on the damage, yes. The reserve. There's an $18,000 reserve which is offered in rebuttal to the plaintiff's allegation that from the very instant this particular adjuster got this file, he was intending to pay nothing and to deny the claim, and that he worked from there on in that respect. We believe the fact that before he did anything and before he had particularly hired the engineer to make an investigation upon which he then relied in denying the claim, that he set a reserve of $18,000 is material in showing that he was not so conceived evilly from the very beginning.
Is the company required to make that reserve by regulations from the insurance commission?
Required to make a reserve, Your Honor, but certainly not for $18,000.
Well, but
yes.
So be it. They have to do it.
They have to put up some amount which they think is sufficient to take care of the claim. That's right. And he could have put up $1,800 since that's what he thought was his actual liability, as it turns out. But the reserve was made for $18,000. Net worth is another item which there's evidence of in this case and which I think will be relied on heavily by the plaintiff in their claim for punitive damages. They want some percentage of the relator's net worth, and we believe that that is an item which should not be gone into in the contract case. My time is up.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. James Pickle will present argument for the respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors.
I asked my gallery to leave for this oral argument. It was here on the last case, just to clear up the courtroom a little bit. It seems to me that based on the questions you all have raised, that I don't have the same insecurity I have sometimes when I go to a court of appeals that maybe the judges haven't read the brief and don't understand the issue. So my argument can be fairly brief because I think, especially in Judge Enoch and Justice Horn, y'all understand what the issue is here. First, and I want to make this real clear, even to you if I need to, there has been no Rule 408 settlement offer in this case. There is a difference between saying, here's your entire claim, we will pay you less than what you are demanding in release and settlement of your entire claim, as under Rule 408 offers, and saying, here's your claim, we're going to pay this part unequivocally, but the rest of this claim we're denying unequivocally, and if you cash the check for the part we give you, we're not going to release you, you're not going to release us, you can still go forward and sue on the other part. That's what happened in this case.
How is that evidence any less prejudicial in the contract case?
Because I don't even need that evidence in my contract case. The only thing I need in my contract case, and like I said in my brief, is the denial letter is the trigger for the breach of contract. We make a claim, they say denied. That is the breach of contract, so that letter comes in as the very evidence of the breach of contract.
Well, maybe my question could be phrased better. Counsel says these lawsuits ought to be tried separately, because if you're going to offer evidence of the offer pre-suit, that will prejudice his client in the eyes of the jury, because it looks like they've already decided that, well, maybe they are responsible, at least in part. And so he says that should not be admissible in the breach of contract case, although it will be admissible perhaps in the bad faith case.
I'm not sure why that wouldn't be admissible in the breach of contract case or why it would be inherently prejudicial. He's saying you have a $50,000 claim, we're going to pay $1,800 of your total claim, and that's all. We're denying
the... How is that admissible in the contract case?
The part about the denial? That's what I'm saying.
So $1,800, how is that admissible in the contract
case? It is, and the court could strike that out. It could delineate...
But it is admissible in the bad faith case.
I don't need it, because that's not the basis for my bad faith case.
Well, isn't it going to come out that somebody offered somebody something?
It's not part of the prima facie part of the case. I wouldn't think it would necessarily need to come out. I guess the defendant could say, well, we offered $1,800 on a $60,000 claim, and therefore we weren't in bad faith. But that is not like in the Millar case, the Caldwell case, the F.A. Richards case. All of those cases had a Rule 408 settlement offer. We're going to pay you this much money for your entire claim, go away. And they said that is prejudicial because under the same theory, Rule 408 is even in the books, that everybody's not a lawyer but doesn't understand that they compromise claims for various reasons other than that they're admitting liability.
And how is it any different that it was for all of it or some of it? Isn't the prejudice the same?
I think it can be explained very easily by the court in limiting...
You can explain both of them, but it looks like if there's prejudice as to one, there's prejudice as to the other. How's it? I don't see any of the difference. You could explain, ladies and gentlemen, don't take this as an admission, but either way, whether it's for all or part, isn't the prejudice the same or not?
I don't think so, because their offer is not... That they are disputing the entirety of the claim. They are. It's as if she had made two claims, and the first claim they paid, and the second claim that came a week later they didn't pay. And the whole case is based on the claim that they didn't pay. The part they did pay, there's no dispute about that. They offered $1,800 to fix the pipe, and so that's not critical, or even I wouldn't even think it'd be admissible because it's not relevant in any of the case.
If there was a single claim and they made an offer of settlement on that, would they be entitled to a separate trial because of the prejudice?
Well, now you're getting into the issue that Caldwell raised, and I could talk for an hour on the problems I think there are in that case. It depends on when that settlement
You don't have
was
quite
made.
That long, so okay. I'll do the best you can.
Well, okay, thanks. I think it depends on when the settlement offer is made. I think if the settlement, and that gets to the one of the final issues I've got in the case, which is, if you are going to want to encourage settlements by insurance companies or anybody, you want to write law that will encourage them to make settlements. And the way you do that is you say, if you make a Rule 408 offer, it will not be admissible if the offer is rejected in the trial of the contract case. In other words, we will have a severance of those two issues. But if you fail to make a Rule 408 offer, everything you do is going to come in. I think that encourages insurance companies to make Rule 408 offers and try to dispose of these cases quickly. I think the opposite rule, which is the one advocated by Liberty, would discourage Rule 408 settlement offers because if they know they're going to get a severance, no matter what, if there's just a bad faith and a contract claim pled together, and they know they're automatically going to get a severance, what's their incentive to make a settlement offer? And not only that, but if you go the step further that they're advocating, which is the loss of the contract case is by automatic operation of law a death knell to the bad faith case, no matter what it's based on, which is what they're advocating, then the insurance company's sitting there going, wow, I won't make a settlement offer because if I win the contract case, I don't have to worry about any of the rest of it. Regardless of what I do in the claim settlement process, regardless of how I treat the insurer, I don't have to worry about it. You will discourage Rule 408 offers if you do that. And I think that's part of what happened when the 14th Court of Appeals came back last year in Lerner, in the Mid-Century case versus Lerner, and they said only if the bad faith case is based solely on the inadequacy of the settlement offer, then you have to have severance. Now, the earlier Houston cases that addressed that issue, the Millar case, the Hunter case, the Wilmore case, they all had Rule 408 offers in them, but the court did not craft its language specifically to say if the bad faith case is based solely on the inadequacy of the Rule 408 offer, then you have to have severance. And I think the Court of Appeals in Houston recognized that problem, and they corrected it in Lerner by adding that language in. You have to have an automatic severance if and only if the bad faith action is based solely on the inadequacy of a Rule 408 offer. And that's what they said. But the real issue here is, are we going to have an automatic rule that in every case, I mean, if the pleading says bad faith and contract, it's automatically going to be divided in half every time, no matter what the facts are? If you're going to have that, you're going to have what Justice Phillips talked about, which is bifurcation, trifurcation. You know, next it'll be DTPA and insurance code cases can't be tried together. You know, next it'll be that the various laundry list violations can't be tried together. You're going to have these cases just chopped into a million pieces, and every district judge in Dallas right now has 3,500 cases on their docket. And triple that, potentially, if you have some ironclad rule.
How is the punitive damage bifurcation working out? Is the jury told in advance, answer these questions, don't worry about the effect of your answers, but don't make any immediate plans for tomorrow?
In actual practice, you mean how's Morial working out?
Yeah, I'm just wondering about how, if you're going to bifurcate and keep the same jury there. This is true in capital cases too, exactly, which I've been fortunate enough never to try. What kind of advanced warning is a jury given about their responsibility?
I haven't tried one of those yet. I got one in June, so I'll find out in San Antonio. But what I think is happening is the same thing they do in a criminal trial. Ladies and gentlemen, the jury, we're going to try this case in two pieces. If you answer certain questions, and I'm not even going to tell you about now, a certain way, there'll be a second phase of the proceeding in which you will answer other questions. And then when they go out the first time, they go out just to answer the first jury charge. They come back with affirmative answers on punitive damages. And they say, ladies and gentlemen, you're lucky enough to have answered these questions correctly. You can spend another day hearing the rest of the case. I think that's how it's working out in practice. And that's the way we've drafted our charge in the San Antonio case, to do it that way. I think that is a much less onerous burden, in other words, to have separate trials, bifurcation, than it would be to say, okay, now we're going to have to come back and try the whole second case again a second time with a new jury after additional discovery if necessary, things like that. As far as that goes, again, the breach of contract case is in Vail, this court decided. The breach of contract case can stand alone. The bad faith case can stand alone. They are not dependent, except in those limited circumstances, like in Millard and F.A. Richard, where the bad faith case is based solely on the failure to pay the contract damages.
How can you possibly have a bad faith case if there's no coverage?
because the bad faith case is an independent tort, which arises out of the way the insurance company adjusts the claim and treats the insured.
If there was no liability?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that if an insurance company, number one, can violate the insurance code and the Claims Settlement Practices Act and the DPPA, even if there is no coverage, by the way it treats its insured, I believe. And I believe this court has intimated that on several of its earlier opinions, including Bay.
Do you concede that there would be some contract and bad faith claims that ought to be settled?
Yes, I do, as a matter of fact. I think that...
And is that because the trying the two of them together is prejudicial? One to the other. Either to one party or both parties.
There's some that have to be automatically settled. I would retract my earlier answer, Justice Heck. I don't think so. I think that with limiting instructions, with the inherent ability of the trial court to enforce those instructions, I think that you would have to have it on a case-by-case basis with every trial judge to decide whether or not it needed to be severed.
Well, I don't think I used the word automatic, but so we'll be perfectly clear. You think, however, there are some cases that ought to be severed when there is a contract and a bad faith claim in the same case. The trial judge ought to sever.
Yeah, I'm not being evasive. I'm just trying to think of the fact situation where that could arise.
Didn't you think the 408 offer of settlement would be on the state?
No, because I think, like in Evans, I think the court can instruct around that. I think the court should instruct around it. And getting to the point that then leads to is mandamus an appropriate remedy here? No. Because they can go through both this trial as a single unit. And if they can demonstrate to the Court of Appeals that there was some prejudice or that the jury ignored the court's limiting instruction, they have reversal on appeal. So there's no reason to have a mandamus. This action, I think, is premature. I don't think that we have the Walker v. Packer inadequate remedy by way of appeal in this case.
So then your answer is there should never be a severance. It can always be handled by curative instruction.
Well, I hate to be absolute about it. I'm trying to think of a fact situation where I would say, if I were a trial judge, for instance, that I would say, yes, you're going to have a severance. Mm-hmm. And I can't think of one, so I guess I'll have to answer. I think the court has the inherent power to limit or instruct the jury according to the law and alleviate the prejudice of that type of an offer. So I guess I'll have to answer your question. No, I can't think of one. But again, I really do want to make it clear that we do not, even if Millard and Wilborn were correctly decided, which I don't think they were, and I think the Houston Court of Appeals has now not backed off of them necessarily, but has clarified what those cases meant in the Lerner case, I still want to make a very clear point that we do not have a Rule 408 settlement offer in this case.
Well, but before you make that point, you also think Lerner is wrongly decided.
Yes. Yeah, I think they're just getting, I think what happened was they spoke a little boldly in Wilborn and Millard, and then they got thinking about what that meant, and they came back in Lerner and said, well, that's not exactly what we meant. What we meant is if this situation comes up, and I think the next stage from there is, well, okay, even Lerner went a little too far, maybe we could always, you know, we could limit around it, have instructions. And I've tried several cases, and I'm depending on what the instruction is about, sometimes they're good and sometimes they're not. I mean, most of y'all have trials every day, you know what that means. I mean, once you ring the bell, sometimes it's hard to unring it. But I don't think the prejudice in a case like this, where really the whole sort of umbrella of what happened in this case, from the purchase of the policy to the damage to the house to the adjustment of the claim to the denial, and in some cases like Millard, a settlement offer made, I think you sort of have to have a flavor for the whole case in order to determine the issues in the case. And I think if you were to divide that up, you're going to have two juries deciding what are essentially different cases, even though they arise out of the same operative facts. And facts do interrelate to each other. And what they're and it's clear what the insurance companies are trying to do here is they're trying to create a severance. They're trying to create a void between the cases, the divide and conquer theory. If you don't get any of this evidence in over here, it won't hurt me. So I'll never have to worry about what I do over here. And if you're never going to get any evidence over here, So the bad thing, I mean, the logical, logical construction of the total severance of the cases would be that in the contract case, no bad faith information comes in, and in the bad faith case, no contract information comes in. Why is it relevant? If the bad faith case is based on something other than the breach of contract, why would it be relevant?
But you agree, it shouldn't come in, and if it comes in a joint trial, there ought to be an instruction, don't consider it as for the other client.
Yes. Yes.
So they're not really trying to gain advantage, they're just trying to get what they're entitled to in the first place. And they're entitled to at least to an instruction, don't listen to it with respect to this claim.
I think they should get an instruction if they can demonstrate that the information would prejudice them. And that's going to be the trial judge's call on a case-by-case basis, is how egregious is this evidence, this bloody knife that's going to come into evidence, how egregious is that? Is there anything inherently about that that is so bad, and I think this goes back to your earlier question, Justice Heck, is there ever a piece of evidence so bad that we have to have a severance? And again, like I say, I can't think of one in an insurance case. I can think of a murder case and things like that, but I can't think of one in an insurance context. Where
in the ordinary contract case, would you think some evidence of bad faith is admissible?
Well, when you say evidence of bad faith, I'm not sure any of the evidence in the case can be pigeonholed like that.
Well, you're claiming a poor investigation.
Right.
Now, wouldn't that possibly be relevant to the contract?
No, I think so. I mean, it'd be relevant to DTPA insurance code by consideration. I don't think it'd be relevant to the contract. This contract claim is, was there a covered event? Did the insurance company pay on a covered event? It's pretty simple. But, yeah, that's my best answer. But again, when you're talking about the entirety of the case and explaining to a jury who's never heard the case 50 times like I have preparing it, you want to give them the flavor of what's happening in the case, the entire case, how the parties related to each other, how this got to be where it is. And there's a lot of art that goes into this. It's not just science. If it were science, we could decide contract cases without juries. We'd just have a computer decide it. But it's more than that. You have to give the jury the flavor of what's happened in the case. And I'm not talking about inflaming the jury, although that happens, I'm sure. I'm talking about just so that they're just not sitting there going, wow, how did we get from here to over here? Nobody explained us this big gap in the middle of the evidence. And so it's hard to say, well, this evidence relates only to this claim, and this evidence only relates to this claim. I think it's in the practical day-to-day reality of trial, and on the firing line, it's really hard to do that. It's really hard to say, this is only relevant here and this is really only relevant there, which again gets back to the limiting instruction. The judge would have to make the call on whether this particular piece of evidence is relevant and should be not instructed and just come in for whatever it can be argued to be worth, or whether it is such a piece of evidence that it only applies to this case, and then number one, and then number two, that it is so prejudicial that there should be a limiting instruction telling the jury to ignore it, the purpose of this case over here. If you drive a hard and fast wedge between these two cases, what you're doing really is you're saying you don't trust juries to follow the judge's instructions. I mean, when it comes right down, you're saying, I'm going to flip Justice Heck's question around. If there's some case where a limiting instruction will not work, why is there any case where a limiting instruction will work?
You would give limiting instruction as to net worth, limiting instruction as to reserves.
Sure. You give limiting instructions in trial all the time. Motions in limine are just, every case I've tried has a motion in limine. Every case I've tried has limiting instructions or definitions to a jury.
But as a trial lawyer, don't you feel a little nervous about limiting instructions? Now, ladies and gentlemen, don't pay any attention to this. Doesn't that kind of wake them up?
Yeah, nothing like having the judge talk from the bench to wake the jury up, for sure. My time is up. Do you have any other questions?
Any other questions? Thank you.
Mr. Gallagher, if this was an arson case,
yes.
It seems
seems to me that there would be a lot of evidence about the investigation of the claim and coming to a determination of whether or not it was covered. It's not covered if the property owner set it on fire. It is covered if somebody else set it on fire. So it seems to me in that circumstance you'd have a lot of back and forth testimony on whether or not the owner of the property set the fire. And then the jury decides this is a covered deal. The owner didn't set it on fire. It seems to me that your notion that there should be a severance in cases between contract and bad faith produces a real problem in the case where arson's one of them. I suppose any car wreck could be the same thing, where you then end up going to, in your argument, a different jury to hear exactly the same evidence, except one additional element, which is, would no reasonable insurance company have relied on this information in denying the claim? So you basically have a new trial on all the same evidence, plus one additional element. Is that really, isn't that giving the insurance company like a second shot at, if they didn't judge, if they didn't convince the jury that they weren't covered by the policy, at least they've got a second shot to kind of review what they did in the first trial and retry it to see if they can avoid the bad faith claim on exactly the same factual underpinnings?
Justice Enick, you may have hit upon an area where it would not be appropriate. I think that that comes into the third area of this, or the third requirement of this court's severance idea, and that is how intertwined the evidence is. And you are suggesting that in an arson case, the evidence on who actually set the fire and how the investigation proceeded to determine who set the fire might be so intertwined with the bad faith evidence that severance would be inappropriate. And I appreciate that, and that may be the case.
Could that apply here in the say a car wreck that I'll pay for the damage to the automobile, but I don't think there's been all this personal injury that's been alleged, and so I'm not paying personal injury. Would that same problem exist in that kind of circumstance?
I think you're moving away once you get from the arson case into something like that, which sounds more like just the liability on the contract. Before long, you're to our case, where it's just a very simple question of whether the leak caused foundation movement, and if so, how much.
Does your answer to Judge Enick's question do away with your position that the severance ought to be automatic if you have a contract claim plus a bad faith claim?
Well, it would in the arson case. I think.
Because as soon as you say that you have to look to whether they're intertwined or not, that's the whole focus of what the trial court's discretion is. So if you're arguing for a cut deal, that they always are severed, you've just destroyed the trial court's discretion, and they don't have the opportunity to exercise it under all the law and the rule that we have in existence now to make a determination whether it's intertwined or not.
Well, I still think that there's can be evidence, Your Honor, on this issue of intertwined, which is so clear that the trial court has no discretion. And I think that's what we have here.
Even if the trial court were to have no discretion, as you argue, why couldn't that error be, in your case, if it's as bad as you say it is, why couldn't it be corrected on appeal?
Your Honor,
we're ever going to let the trial court look at it, as in the arson case.
Right.
Then why, if the trial court looks at it and gets it wrong, and there is prejudice that's incurable that leads to an unfair verdict, why can't that be handled by appeals?
Obviously, someday, Your Honor, on the appeal, that issue could be corrected on appeal. I think it's...
Well, within our recent writings on mandamus, makes this fall into the kind of case that we should correct now.
I think so, Your Honor.
What would you draw from Walker or some other case to say this needs to be corrected now rather than waiting to see how the trial comes out?
Because of is strong evidence that both sides, in this case, wish to offer on the bad faith case. For example, there's at Statement of Facts 19, Volume 2, Mr. Pickle says that he wishes to redepose the adjuster and introduce evidence that Mrs. Broderick has been paid $40,000 on prior claims, and that that has prejudiced the adjuster in this case to this preconceived idea of what to do with the claim. Says he wants to take the adjuster and ask this question to him. He doesn't care whether the adjuster answers yes or no. That doesn't make any difference. He wants to get that into the jury box. I believe that that evidence, along with the rest of the evidence, Your Honor, is so compelling that we have met every criteria that this court has set for severance, that Judge Aiken had no discretion in this case.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes this argument. The court will take a 2.5-hour recess.